So yesterday I kind of talked mainly about the topology, and I kind of very quickly rushed through the second type of modeling effort that we did to try and understand how to look at averages of this force transmission. And but maybe I wonder if it'd be worthwhile to, since I kind of went through the topology part kind of maybe quickly, I don't know if there are other questions we want to talk about that before we move on to implementing that in a specific model.
I would begin clicking the slides and then let us interrupt with questions.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. Okay. So I'll just kind of get to the part where started talking about you probably made a lot of money off that picture, I would think. Okay. All right, so here is just going through kind of the general way it looks when you're trying to calculate these response functions. And we just started off with the observation that when you look, actually, well, when we actually did look at specific packs, we found that there is this directed nature to the response in terms of the topology of it. And it could be understood, for instance, if you look at the topology of the graph, it could be understood as rigidity building out from the boundary. But that's one way to look at it. But more generally, if you take a packing and you can ask what are kind of the rigid, if I want to think about it as decomposing the rigidity of the entire thing, I can break it down into like irreducible rigid subgroups. And one thing I didn't mention yesterday is that this type of analysis, I found out later, actually just recently, that this type of analysis is used in CAD programs for people who are interested in robotics. Because, for instance, suppose you're designing a motorcycle. So there are some moving parts and other things are kind of moving as a rigid subgroup. And it turns out that the efficient way to deal with that computationally is to first represent all the constraints as a graph. So in internal to the program, they actually represent the motorcycle as a graph, like wheels connected to axles, so or something like that. And that's like that's an edge with the two vertices. And so they have this kind of constraint graph, and then they can analyze it graphically. And they do kind of the same. I found out they do kind of the same thing. They look at what are the irreducible kind of rigid subgroups. So what's convenient is I found out that so there's been some analysis on what is the most, what are good ways to do it graphically and not. But it turns out I found out that they also, kind of quick and dirty way, which is what we ended up doing, was if you know some place is rigid like this boundary, you basically can build out your rigidity recursively. It turns out that doesn't get you through every graph, but that gets you through a lot of the easy parts of the graph. Another part of doing the rigidity decomposition is that, for instance, this one is not rigid, but it depends on only two other particles. So this one, you also know the rigidity right away because this one has to depend on those two through the two independent legs. So you can either build up from the boundary like this, or you can look for nodes which have two edges and you can build back down. So you can basically go through a graph and kind of map it out. Okay. So that was what we looked at yesterday. And so here's basically the main picture then. So we have this connectivity graph. And so if you look, for instance, all these points which have only every node which has two legs, they're all, of course, always outgoing like they're always going out like that. Although the corner disks have two, no matter how many are touching this corner disk, there's these two touching the boundaries, so these are the outgoing ones. And once this becomes part of the boundary, then this one, you can consider this to be like a sink for the information of how the force is going to be resolved. So that means this guy touches the boundary and this, so this acts effectively as a boundary, so you know that this now points that way and this one points that way as well.
Going left, down,
yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, this is where it also comes down to this. We don't look at kind of accidental degeneracies, like the box is not exactly the sum of the diameters. So you're never going to be able to exactly pack them all the way across. So there's always going to be some mismatch, and that's going to be, assuming, well, you could have more than one of these, but if you just have one, then it'll run that way. Yeah. So I think that's why also another question, Corey was kind of pushing yesterday about, well, you can see very evidently the effect of the boundary in here, so we really don't know how that propagates longer distances if you have a really big pile. I think that's kind of an interesting thing. Okay, so let me just, maybe this is a good place to kind of introduce also what the motivation was for the second half of the talk. So really the reason why we did this originally was we started off with this ensemble mentality, which is, okay, we started off with this procedure for forming packs. We pour grains into a bucket, do the same thing over and over. And assuming you can, so we have to say, first of all, what piles are possible. I think maybe that's very similar in spirit to, in the Edwardsian approach, I guess, just thinking about what is kind of mechanically acceptable. And that's not easy to specify right off, but this kind of partially answers that question at least. And then the second thing was, if you can kind of specify the ensembles, then how do you translate that to how the force propagates? So our original idea was, well, if we want to know, actually, let me go back. The other type of question we wanted to answer was, suppose instead of having spheres, you have like coins in a bucket, not coins, but maybe something M&M, say. And if you push your hand into a bucket of M&Ms, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to do that, but it's noticeably, it's fairly noticeable, actually, the amount of stress you can sustain compared to spheres. And part of that is because of the ordering. So there's kind of the axis of the M&Ms are all ordered, and part of it is the way the stress is transmitted. So we wanted to kind of, I think in the back of our minds, what we want to do was to say, well, if I have an M&M which is lying like this, and it tends to lie on M&Ms below in a certain way, first I need to capture that geometric relationship, and then I need to take that geometric information and plug it into a model for how the force gets sustained. Okay, so that's what we wanted to do. And right off, we could see that there are a number of issues of trying to, suppose we did know the distribution of these. Okay, so one thing is we map this problem into a scattering problem. So if I press on here, then basically this force is resolved, or quote unquote scattered, like this, and then this leg of that scattered force is then scattered. And it always scatters into two and it keeps going. And the thing is sometimes they recombine. This is not so much a recombination as the superposition of kind of two different paths. Okay, so they happen independently. So it's not nonlinear. That's one example of where it's not nonlinear in the sense of these double Y models. But one thing that is complicated about the scattering is that it happens in this kind of quench disorder. So these grains are fixed, and the fact that you go this way and you come back, they have to hit the same. Once you come here, they both have to scatter along these two routes. So we already kind of anticipated if we want to do this, we have to know how to handle that kind of averaging problem. So to simplify things, we said, okay, we'll back off from these types of packs, and we're going to look at more simple packs, one that's close to a lattice. That was kind of the spirit of it. Okay, so that's kind of the preamble to the second half, but I'll step through the rest of these. Just let me know if you have questions about these parts here. So one thing on your talk, Bob, this morning, that's why I was asking about whether you see these decompressions. And one thing I realized is that I guess this, you're going to probably see these much more often. I'm guessing that you'll see this more often in the isostatic type limit compared to the elastic situation where, and I kind of have two ways of thinking about that. One is like, well, we know from continuum elasticity looks that way, first of all. But secondly, the second thing, as I pointed on in the slides a bit further on, is when it starts becoming hyperstatic and you start seeing the appearance of the elastic mode, you get superpositions of these type of responses. And we know that, for instance, when you add all of these up, gravity on each one, even though this particular one is decompressive here, when I add the other ones in, this decompression gets overwhelmed by the compressive parts. And it, That might be a reason why in the elastic, when it becomes hyperstatic, you don't see the decompression as much. Okay. All right, so then we talked a little bit about how you could end up with irreducible groups, which are not single points, but maybe triangles, for instance, here. So there's an irreducible rigid group. And now, having an orientational degree of freedom, I need three legs to sustain, to rigidify it. Okay. Okay. All right. All right, so let's come now to this second model then. So,
can we go back to the game?
Okay. This one?
For the game, let's say, the game may be appropriate to show there, because in fact it's under more compression than probably than your free surface problem.
Right, right.
Makes it more complicated.
Yes.
And the friction, the possibility of friction may improve.
Yeah.
So it's not clear that you'd be a champion at that game.
No.
Yeah.
No, not yet. Right. Yeah, in fact, we played a game right after. Yeah, I'm not sure I did any better, but I do know that there are some places you can see that you have to have friction. And this spring is actually pretty tight here. So these are.
That's what I mean. Is it fair to say that your analysis is most suitable to lightly loaded states?
Okay, so I have a couple of diverging thoughts on that. One is that in kind of a Coulomb's law point of view, I guess everything's going to scale. So I don't know that if you're just turning on gravity, I don't know if that would change anything. It might have to do with having low coefficients of friction.
It might have more to do with how much strain the system's undergone. Once it's had the strain in it, it's going to be less isostatic. Typically, if you increase the stress on it, it will strain a bit.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the limit of related elasticity. If you compress it or strain enough that you cause, if you compress it,
I'm thinking of, it's not clear to me why I asked that question or why I said that.
Yeah.
I think it's probably the elasticity issue.
Yeah. Elasticity of individual grains.
Yeah.
Yeah, individual games, grains, right.
Because, if you strain them shear, then you open contacts. If you
strain, because of dilatancy. Yeah. Or. One thing I would just say is that if these are perfectly hard, when you bring this top guy in, you actually only increase the number of contacts by one. In other words, before you did this, this was some pile, it's got a rough surface. When you bring it in, you hit the first guy, that's one contact.
That. Okay, that's a good point.
And then as you keep pushing, what happens is you break one off, but then you stop when you get the next one. And as you increase the stress, the constant stress, but increasing stress, you break and re-break, and the number of contacts is just the original plus one.
Okay, so that's fine.
Yeah.
So it is a system that in that idealization,
frictionless,
is equivalent to the one.
That's
you're
right. Doing. That's right. Plus one elastic mode,
right.
Which corresponds to the net compression. Okay. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to then build another pack, which we had much better control of the statistics of, and there that we knew where all the outgoing legs were. And so we thought we could do that by trying to build a pile which looked kind of like a lattice. We didn't want an exact lattice with monodispersed disks, because then it's not isostatic. So the pile that we built, but we wanted some disorder, so we didn't want just the square lattice. So the pile that we actually built was basically a hexagonal lattice, but the disks are different sizes. And I guess these type of models have been studied, where if you make them all different sizes and you clamp them in, you see it forms essentially an isostatic graph. But we decided to make each one slightly larger than the previous one, and that way we could control, in fact, the distribution of the way these guys, the new ones, could contact the existing surface. So just imagine, start off, as you drop a particle in one at a time, it lands in a random spot that's locally mechanically stable. And then so you have this surface which is growing, and you just kind of keep building. So so these are the kind of locally mechanically stable arrangements you could have. So imagine below here, it's a hexagonal packing. So this is a new particle. So when it lands, it can land basically on top of two adjacent neighboring particles like that. So that would be mechanically stable. Or, all right, there could be another particle here. This is the new particle that's introduced. It could land in a spot where, because this was added after this one is slightly larger. So this one will actually, implicitly there's another particle here, but it's just smaller enough that this is actually not seen as a particle. So I didn't just pick that one. So then this is the way that particle sustained. And there's this mirror image. And then the other possibility is that maybe this is all filled in. There is a particle here, but since this particle is a little bigger, it actually will sit slightly above. So that's the third way to contact. Now it turns out, I think this is probably, in reality, not very easy to sustain because you need to maintain quite a bit of horizontal force to just hold this up for very shallow angles. But we just went ahead as using this as kind of our model of building a pile. So we just drop them in, each one's bigger, and we just kind of randomly build up the stack. And it turns out that you can solve for the steady state of what that surface looks like, what the distribution of these guys are, the nearest neighbor correlations. So you have a pretty good handle on the statistics of the pile. And the other thing is, as was mentioned yesterday, in the case of sequential deposition, you also know how topologically it's decomposed. Basically, when this, because everybody else has already rigidified, when this one lands, then these two will be how the force is transmitted. So in this case, the history of the piling is coincident with how the force is transmitted. Okay. So here's an example. So what we do is we just start building the pack. So we just pile up grains. And so the pile actually goes up to about here somewhere. And what we did is, and the pile might be irregular, it might not be flat. But then we take this point and we press down and we just measure what the force response is as it scatters its way down here. Okay. So just like before, you get compression and decompression. And so that was one instance. So then we can start to take the ensemble average, which maybe is similar to the average that, I guess, is the same average that you took in Spirit. Maybe not the same system, but the same type of average. And what we find is that there are quite large fluctuations. So basically, you can maybe see it on the screen here, and by the time it comes on the projector, it's too fuzzy here, but basically, when you take this average, you start to see that the fluctuations get really large very quickly as you move down the pile. So after here's 100 instances, here's 1,000,000 instances, and you, like right here, you're pressing on the middle, and you can probably see in this, okay, row 1, row 2, row 3, row 4, row 5, it's already not symmetric about the midline, which can't be the case. So you know that here the fluctuations are already larger than the mean. So for 1,000,000 instances, by the time you're in row 5, it's too large. Now, we kind of realize that what's happening is that when it's going down and scattering, most of the time, as Josh pointed out, in the hexagonal lattice, whenever you bifurcate along hexagonal directions, the force magnitude is the same as the incoming. So one scatters into one like this. Let me just back up here to this. So it turns out if you have one coming straight down, or let me see here. I guess it wouldn't be. Well, okay. Sorry. If you have one coming in diagonal like this, that turns into one and one. If it comes in like this, that's again one and one. If you come like this, it just passes through, of course. And if you have force coming to the side, because later on the scattering actually includes horizontal scattering. So when the scattering comes in from the side, this turns into 1 and minus 1. So actually these three just actually conserve the magnitude. However, with decompression, that's the difference between the double Y model. Here, though, what happens is 1 coming in gets turned into some very large number related to the inverse of the sign or something. So what happens is every now and then you hit something and your magnitude like just gets amplified by a factor of 1,000 or whatever related to that angle. And so what happens is with time, with averaging, you just get multiplicative amplification of that noise. So sometimes it's called random multiplicative process. Now, I think Mukarzil actually pointed this out. He did a different type of analysis where he looked at isostatic graphs. So he wasn't, it was a different system. But he just noticed that when you have isostatic graphs, if you, and this is also related to what was pointed out by Witten, and I can't remember whether that's the same paper where Alexei Pitenko was on, but where if you press at one point, you could have actually displacements far away, which are fairly large. And Mukarzil talked about that in terms of a pentagraph type motion. So if you actually move something over here, you could cause large displacements far away. So those were discussed in terms of displacement. This is a little different. This is actually in the force. So the force is amplified far away. But I think it's kind of related in spirit. So I think there's a question then of basically kind of an eigenvalue question in the average. Like, you know, here you have basically kind of a large eigenvalue, and as it keeps going on, it's going to blow up. Whereas maybe another type of pile we thought about looking at was, suppose that I think we were talking about making it smaller and smaller. So then this one actually would actually fall and would actually land on either, I think basically on either this or this. And maybe we should have done that, but we didn't do that at first because we thought, well, we have to introduce a probabilistic element. It wouldn't be deterministic the way that, well, I mean, we were picking randomly where to put it, but we were trying to minimize the amount of extra randomness we were adding. Right. You wouldn't support that. I agree. I think it's physically actually much more realistic to get rid of this and let it fall through. I think we just didn't get around to going back to looking at that model. So we just kind of, anyway, that might end up resolving the problem of taking the average. Okay. Numerically, there's a problem here because it blows up so quickly. All right. That's why the average, actually, numerical average is the fluctuations get very large very quickly. All right, so here's where we try to now compare it to kind of a Boltzmann equation. So we said, okay, the force comes in, it hits the scattering center, and there are four, in this model, there are four scattering types, which correspond to the four I showed you earlier. And what happens is then, so this incoming force splits into two, and each one then encounters another scattering type, one of the four. And it turns out, actually, for this particular file, it turns out to be 25% each of the scattering types. And so what we said, okay, the first thing we'll do is we'll just do a mean field uncorrelated scattering theory. What we'll do is we'll say, when it comes in, it's going to hit one of those four, 25%. Okay, the two legs split off. Those two legs go in different directions. I'll just look at this leg. I'll forget about what the other leg is doing. I'll just look at this leg, and this one hits another scattering center. I'll just roll another four-sided die and pick one of the four. I keep going. Okay, so you can be, and because it's all discrete, you can actually just implement that numerically and calculate what it gives you. I'm actually kind of giving you the punchline already, but let me just show you. Oh, yeah, so this is the uncorrelated one. And it's a little, and this is gives kind of this, I guess you could call it a kind of a two-peak type response. But what we found is that when we looked, but we were going to compare it to the numerical average, but the problem is we really only could compare in these first four or five levels. So I can't actually really make any comment about what the right answer is for this model is further down, whether it's one or two peaks, for instance. But when we looked in detail up here, let me show you here. I see. I'm sorry. I'm giving you the short version. Okay. All right. I mean, the long version is not that much longer, so don't worry. Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. I was wondering why I didn't explain anything. All right. So here's so here are the four types of scattering, and what's going on here? Oh. Okay. We don't really need to look at this in detail. Let me just say that Okay, let me just continue the line of thought I had on before. So here's the uncorrelated scattering, and when you can compare in detail. So if you look at, let's see, is this one correlated? Oh, I don't think I brought the uncorrelated ones because they were not very good. Within a second depth, it's already bad. In fact, it's bad right in the particle directly below where you're pressing. The fact that it needs to come back, I mean, there's a lot of correlation at that, just two scattering events away. So the fact that you're missing that right off, you're actually missing a lot right away. So that seems to be a problem. So what we did was we said, okay, we'll just try to patch this up by putting in some of the correlations we know we should be there locally. And so one correlation we put in, for instance, is that we know that if there was a scattering, okay, so imagine I had scattering from higher up and it hits the scattering center right here. Okay, so this scattering now has, whatever came in here now has two outgoing legs. Suppose one went this way and one went somewhere else. So the one that went this way, this scattering center, I know, cannot be one which scatters back, because I know the graph is completely directed. So the only type of scattering here could be either the one that points down like that or the one that points like that. So there are only two types. In other words, let me just say that again. Like, if whatever came out of here, and it could be either the one where the two were going out, or one where this was going to the left and one was going down like this, whatever happens over here, we just say that we know that when this one goes this way, I cannot have one of the scattering centers that actually scatters me right back immediately. I hope that was not too convoluted the way I described it. So what we did was we just said, okay, since we keep track of, we know in our Boltzmann equation, since one of the inputs in the Boltzmann equation is the incoming force, I don't have to add too much more, I don't have to keep track of more information. I can just use this piece of information to tell me that the scattering kernel is a function of that incoming force, and I just eliminate the ones which are inconsistent with that. I put that in. Okay. So that's our correlated model. Okay, so, and you can see when you put the correlations in, you start to see kind of qualitatively different results. You get kind of bands of compression and decompression. And I'm not claiming that these are right. In fact, I'll show you that these are actually already wrong, not too many levels down. So I'll show you that right now. So what these curves are, these are basically the magnitude of the force at different layers of the pile. Okay, so this is just one layer down. This is one, so I'm pressing at the top on some particle, I'm looking just one layer down. And so what you see is one layer down, it's compressive, so let's see, so I'm pressing at 50. Let's see, so I guess right next to it tends to be decompressive, and then there's kind of compression afterwards and it dies off. And the simulation and the and that correlated Boltzmann equation do pretty well here. And I think that's basically because we've captured basically one level, one nearest neighbor correlation. So that's enough. You go down one layer, that's all that's happened. And you actually, that part is basically, I don't remember whether it's exact, but it's essentially correct. I think one of the things that can happen, I just mentioned, when you press here, there's some possibility that it scatters out to the right and then comes back. Because I can have horizontal scattering that kind of drop down one level and come back. Okay, so, but however, if you just go to the second level down, you see that a few further away from where you press, it's actually not doing too bad. But right underneath, it's not even getting the sign correct. Okay, and I think that's because the next nearest neighbor correlations are still important. So just kind of patching up the nearest neighbor was actually only bought us a little bit longer lease on life, not much more. And then it gets kind of worse and worse. Okay. So the way I would summarize the issue here is that the thing is, we have to respect the fact that there's this quench disorder. And we haven't, at this point, figured out how to calculate that average. In other words, we want to throw down a pattern of scattering centers and basically figure out what the response is at a point, and then throw down another pattern. And for each pattern, basically I have to know that as that force scatters. It always, whenever it hits the, reaches the same point in space, it needs to scatter the same way. And that correlation could be arbitrarily long in scattering length. I mean, you could basically go all the way out this way and come back, and even two points which are spatially just, you know, the shortest path length might be two, but the longest path length is arbitrary. So that's kind of the technical issue that we've come up against. Okay, so kind of summarize this then. So we chose a simple model in order to analyze it, and we found that we could get the steady state probabilities, and we analyzed it assuming no spatial correlations, assuming nearest neighbor correlations. And we compared it with the numerical simulation of the same model. We found, at least for the case that we chose, fluctuations are exponentially large. I didn't point out, but those bimodal responses, they were not on axis for the lattice. So those are off-axis bimodal responses. And spatial correlations, we put some in, and we can see they have a big effect, even though we don't get the right answer. So we know that spatial correlations are important. And we know that comparing no spatial correlations to the numerical part that we can get correctly shows that there's an effect. And nearest neighbor correlation was inadequate beyond a couple of layers. I think that's pretty much it. So this one is pretty much, we kind of just stopped after a point where we couldn't push it any farther. Or actually, Jeremy graduated. And we actually don't really have an answer for how to take those averages. So thanks very much.
But then this provides you with intuition about other models too, doesn't it? I mean,
what do you have in mind?
Well, I'm thinking, well, what about the Y model?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is your topological studies, and now your experience with the with the Boltzmann equation.
Yeah.
What's your evaluation of the Y model?
Well, my feeling about the Y model is that it's in some ways it's so similar. In some ways it's pretty similar, but in other ways, there are a couple of things which are essentially different. And I'd say the main thing is probably that in the Y model, the basic thing that scattering is the sum, is total magnitude on the force chain. So you know, you say on this contact I've got this much force, and that's going to split into two. But that's different from what we see here. And when we want to get that force change, we actually do the independent scattering from the different centers, and then we add them up afterwards to get the force change. So it could be that the Y model, there's maybe a variant could be made of the Y model. I mean, other things need to be changed, like you need to allow decompression, I think.
There's always a question, you know, how generic that precise statisticity.
Yeah.
But each time you get an extra contact, it gives you one more degree of freedom. How does that affect? So say you have one of these somewhere in your lattice, does that lack in this sort of hyperbolic?
Okay. Yeah, I think, I have an answer for that, but maybe that reminded me of another thing. In answer to Jim's question earlier, I think in terms of loops, I think a big issue that, I mean, this is my one intuition I have is like in the double Y model, there's a lot of divergences that come up, and it's because I think it's because the population that you're trying to, it's not well controlled, because you have these things, you can have things that kind of keep splitting and. And they keep, you know, in the same region of space, you could have something just kind of swirling around, just bifurcating, spinning off force chains. And I think, that never happens here, because it happens on this kind of quenched pattern. But that's not a problem. We can identify that that's why, but we don't, on the other hand, we don't know how to do the quenched average. But I am thinking that may be part of the problem. That might be what the trouble is with some of the in the Y model as well.
You create a particular brand of an isostatic network. And so there's presumably something special about it in the sense that it may or may not be generic. One, I mean, you grow it in particular ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are obviously many ways that you could create an asymptotic network.
Yeah.
But so it seems like immediate one question on my point of way about is, what other ways could you grow these?
Yeah. Right.
So you can still, if you grow one of these, you can actually grow the network.
Yeah.
So as opposed to doing a Boltzmann thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then simply say, I'm going to take a collection of these, grow them from this.
Yeah.
And I can imagine computing a business function.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. How do you find that? Is there anything you think that could do?
Oh, maybe.
As the
Oh, wait, maybe I missed the distinction early on in that question. Sorry.
There's really two questions.
Yeah.
One is, it seems like you create a particular brand.
Yeah.
And that may or may not.
Right, we need to check to see other ways of building isostatic hacks and see.
If you start with one possible, you've got very gradually, and you do three other possible.
Yeah.
To make sticks, you're going to be nothing works.
Well, you will actually. Well, it depends on.
You need some type of force. They have to be under some kind of compression.
Well, if you have a DLA type situation where you had colloids sticking one at a time, that would be essentially sequential deposition. And the first rigidified group would be the first triangle that you made. And then rigidity would go from there, so. Well, yeah, but it's the same as this boundary. I mean, the bucket could be freely moving, but, relative to the bucket being your reference of something that's rigid. And I think if you just start with a particle, that would be the reference point. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Right. That's right. Just like the boundaries here don't have arrows coming out of it. So you can form the boundary, for instance, by just imagining it's a big particle. And that's kind of the same scenario. So let's see. Okay.
Okay. Suppose rather than trying to generate a Boltzmann type description by copying along, what if you simply do what's done in the experiment, which
is
you can look at your set of responses from which you generate the global response, and you look at that distribution.
So isn't that, how is that different from what I showed, maybe?
I guess maybe that's the question. Is that different from?
I think that's what I try to do. Yeah, I think that's what these...
Does that end up being the same as...
I think that's what these were, if I understand.
Yeah, so it's today, okay.
So, maybe in some sense, if we want to use this to interrogate other questions, like for instance, the unimodal versus bimodal, maybe we should change our pile so it's more realistic, and then we wouldn't have to bother with the Boltzmann equation. We could just look at this and see whether it's single or bimodal. Yeah.
And then, as long as you relax the source of your quasi-single behavior, then
Yeah. I think that. That's true.
The isostatic is close to physical reality.
Well, so I do think that when you if you do the right thing, you can really generate these things physically, or get close to them physically, and they're probably relevant in relatively dilated shearing systems.
But what we call that is just generating.
Mechanically?
Yeah,
mechanically. With the sliding.
The sliding.
Yeah.
And it's
by
loop, but it's not successful.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think you're right. There's rigid particles, lightly loaded, sheared. But that ought to be said more, I think, because the impression is that it may have even more general validity than that. I mean, but I agree that there exist systems where it's relevant.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, one idea that's come up also is that is that you know, when you look from a soil mechanics say point of view, when you're at the yield, when you're at the yield point, that's a point where you're basically, up to that point as you're pressing, you're basically losing contact, and almost kind of by definition, yielding is at the point of marginal stability. So now the friction complicates the issue, but perhaps when you're at the point of yield, then that's the point when you're most likely to have an isostatic.
The yield surface is an isostatic.
Yeah.
Robin Ball would be happy to hear you say that.
Yeah. I know, yeah, so...
You're thinking on those terms.
Yeah.
I'll challenge that somewhat by saying that if you have... So if I originally had, say, compressed my system,
yeah,
and then sheared the failure,
yeah,
I'm not so sure that you'd be rather close to isostatic.
That's not what you find?
Well, so the way we actually get these things to be close to isostatic is we start with a minimal number of... So all contacts are nascent. Okay? So you squeeze it down to some point where you see the force change, you relax it,
mm-hmm,
to the point where all the forces have disappeared visually.
Yeah.
And then you say you shear it. And that sets up something which really is quite close to isostatic experimental.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had compressed it first and not relaxed and then sheared, I'm sure I could get it fairly. And I'm not so sure that
I would
be.
Yeah.
So I think it's not clear that universally.
Right.
Shearing, for instance.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this element of compression kind of puts you out of the...
Maybe that's the way. Too far.
Yeah.
And, you know, so in his heuristic, so in his way of generating these things, he is in a very loose pack situation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he's been wondering. Maybe 2 weeks ago or the past week, there were lots of discussions on slowly sheared, continuously sheared systems, you know, with let's say of identical spheres, somewhere between a line fraction of 0.55 and 0.63 or something like that, and he was speculating, mm-hmm, you know, exactly
right.
The nature of those systems and whether they might be isostatic or coming close to
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But those typically did have some compressive loading. They weren't as free,
mm-hmm,
as the systems that you're describing.
And these are numerical models, I assume.
Well, there were some physical experiments too.
Oh, okay. So the numerical models was the answer. And you can say with pretty reasonable level of assurance.
So slowly sheared. Slowly sheared. Who's done the simulations? I mean, I don't know. So maybe Francois Chevoix. So maybe they do exist simulations. I mean, I don't think they're isostatic. I don't think they're even close.
Well, we should ask Luke, mm-hmm, because he has done this as,
yeah,
well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that they're not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When they're under compressive load.
Mm-hmm. So that when they land back, then basically the tangential friction is very low.
Yeah. So that there might be isostatic in the frictionless sense.
So what you might do is reduce the friction loss. I'm not convinced you're going to reduce the formation of that. So I have experimental evidence to the contrary.
The coordination will double increase a lot.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Much higher for,
right,
for an isostatic, yeah, friction loss.
It's a Coulomb law thing, right? I mean, if you reduce the friction, you also reduce the normal force, right? I mean, you never get rid of the friction, so I'm So therefore, I don't see how the fact that you reduce the strength of the contact necessarily of frictional particles somehow pushes them closer to being frictionless.
Well, no, when they adjust towards the state of the friction, the frictionless particles might
achieve. Yeah, that's all
right.
Let me ask a question about it. Might be relevant.
Mm-hmm. So when we're really frictional particles together, we keep isostatic. So we'll get new force. Is that not an issue?
When you're in this state, but it's the isostatic state of shear, then there's the possibility of talking about the Edwards temperature. So my question is, so that's fine. So what is that going to get us? How is that thermodynamic description, what is that going to be able to say about the system if we achieve that state?
If you choose an isostatic state?
You're continuously shearing, you're confident you're in an isostatic state, you're perhaps measuring an Edwards temperature.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with such a curve?
Yeah, what do you, so... I mean, then can you employ all of the thermal dynamic or thermostatic apparatus from...
I think that's a very good question. What is it ever good for, right? And to be truthful, I mean, I think some of the arguments of trying to predict things like P of L are some of the first useful things that I've seen done with an Edwards entropy concept. So I think the answer is it's not clear at all, because if you have rigid particles and you take two of its entropy description, then you don't have anything that tells you sort of about irreversible energy input into your system or anything like that, right? And it's purely volumetric. So that kind of concept, if you haven't generalized it for some sort of, I don't see how you can describe heat, for instance, that way, because that involves putting energy into a mode that you can't get it out from. And I don't see how that comes into play, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I think of other ways that you might think about trying to describe energy you put into a system that you can't. So some other kind of temperature you might contemplate using.
Okay.
So suppose, well, then do all the elastic modes in that system.
Yeah.
Okay, then I have one which is, say, fill the macroscopic modes in my system.
Yeah.
And all the others are the thermal back.
Right.
And they certainly exist for
pragmatic
stuff.
Sure.
So if I want to think in that terms, that set of terms, I could imagine a generalized temperature. But that's now rather different from what I think the Edwards entropy would like to be.
Mm-hmm. And the temperature you speak of is more accessible to me. I mean,
right.
So I mean, mm-hmm. It has to do with particle deformations, not with numbers of stages and numbers
right.
of stages.
So I think we'll talk about an attempt to try and do that. Where I think you then supposed to try to say, oh, okay, there is something like heat, and I want to look at the irreversible elements.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I had I remembered I on the queue I was going to ask you had a question that I never answered, which was what happens when you have extra contact? How does that change? And this actually ties into Bob's comment about the need to look at other types of isostatic packings. And so this is actually one thing that I started working on with Philippe Claudin, where I guess it started off with Gaël Combe and Jean-Noël Hou and. Make these isostatic packs by compressing, just tossing disks in and compressing without gravity, just biaxially. And it kind of goes back to this toy. let me see, where's it? Oops, am I going the right way? There you go. Yeah, there it is. So the thing is, when you have this toy, as I mentioned, you have this one extra contact. Now, the thing is, suppose you form this pile by gravity, and then you come and hit that first particle. Well, then that's actually the same as before. I actually know how. Then, I can consider this wall as producing a force here, and then it scatters through the rest of the pack. But as I keep pressing, and I break a contact, and I make the next contact, so this guy will now touch two, some two, then it's not fully connected here. That's the situation where it's, I'm still trying to figure out whether, you know, how to analyze that situation. So I think that's kind of that's kind of the example of type of packing we're going to be looking at. Now that doesn't actually completely answer your question, Jim, about what happens when you have an suppose you have an isostatic pack like I showed you before, and you have one extra in here. That actually, it's easy to compose that one because that actually turns out to be just a sum. You can take that stress as though whatever stress that occurs there and decompose it into as if there are individual forces on this one and that one. And that becomes an addition of those two. So that happens in, so when you have an extra contact, that's the same as when you squeeze from the side. So before, when we were talking about, so if you squeeze from the side, you get one elastic mode every time you make contact. If you squeeze from, if you actually make them softer and for some reason they sag and you get an extra contact here, that's as if you apply, that's the same as applying kind of a force couple on those two. So that can be analyzed that way. So you can see the kind of the superposition of these isostatic responses coming out, and that average leading towards something more Gaussian.
So if you have a large, most of the time you're doing experiments in 2D or something, so you displace some force, and then all this propagates towards the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But there also is, for a continuum theory anyway, there is a symmetrical case where you are entering the expanse, you're putting two equal and opposing.
Uh-huh.
Forces.
Right.
And now these things will propagate towards each other, going on a common surface. So in the continuum theory, this is called something like an image function, ring function, but this isn't going to be the same then in these types of theories, because somehow these propagating things are exactly going to have to match up.
Yeah, and this is,
So even though you've got this idea of propagating things, it has to be elliptic, because these things actually have to match up.
Well, they don't. See that? Well, because the intuition you have is, I think, it's built on the elliptic case. That's why. But if you did it in the hyperbolic case, that's not what would happen.
What would happen if you've got a large expanse, say, you're very far from boundary, and you apply two equal and opposing forces?
Well, if you're. Yeah. See, in the hyperbolic case, the boundary always plays a role.
In the hyperbolic or the elliptic?
Well, okay, so I'm thinking like the whole system, you have the bonds holding, you need some compressive. So you're going to be slightly hydrostatic, the whole thing has to be compressed as well. The whole thing has to be compressed a bit.
Yeah.
There has to be some confining pressure. But then you take two particles, some distance apart, and you're trying to compress it.
Yeah. Okay, so there are different pieces of information I can bring to try to. To help maybe my intuition in answering that question. One is, I know if I take these packs and I take, say, this point and this point and press them together, I don't end up with something that's just localized in there. It actually goes to the boundary. I think another continuum case which might be similar is, we know that if you look at
that's really, that's totally different from the continuum case, and where doing this would be the same as having a boundary on the plane.
Oh, you're talking about like an image?
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
In the elastic case?
Yeah.
But does that always... Because I'm thinking... the other case I'm thinking about is in wave propagation, so where you get the advanced and the retarded Green's function.
Well, then, so that sort of works there, because you may always make these assumptions about no incoming radiation.
Yeah, so there you know the boundary plays an explicit role.
Yeah,
so and there, you know,
yeah, it makes sense, it's complicated.
Yeah. So I'm wondering whether that means that, you know, the intuition that it always, you can really always get rid of the boundary. Well, we know that doesn't work, for instance, in wave propagation. So it may not be kind of a general thing, and here this might not necessarily be kind of a counter example to that. if that's not a rule that holds for all continua.
But I don't think Bob's birefringent, you better correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think Bob's birefringent system is a good system to test isostatic notions.
Well, again, this is more general when it's asked about, which I'm wrong. But you know, you should track the background force in this and see whether what we can say is okay.
I think the answer is it's not going to, I don't think you're going to see something pure, terribly hyperbolic out of that.
Well, do you think it would look like, do you think it would look like bipolar?
Sure.
Probably.
But I mean, the one case where you could imagine doing that is when you prepare the special trade state, and there I think you are probably pretty close to having some problems. So these law of course changes you push on them, and I think that, yeah. But you know, it will be. You can only do that in one direction.
Although maybe in those cases, I mean. Since you have the force chains at long-range correlations, I mean, if you were to now press this way, you know, that would cause some, essentially, a force on these guys, which would be long-range going off to the side also, right?
Is it in the perpendicular way?
So the shears going, the force chains are going this way, and if you take two particles and press this way, like towards each other, then you're going to convert some of that force to, on particle over here, say, pushing this way, and that, if it's consistent with what you saw, it would just kind of keep propagating. So that would be kind of a counterexample of it being localized as a dipole. That kind of, based on what you showed, it seems reasonable it would do that. But, Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Well,